we'll go on to case number two. Appeal 23-2964, Jose Agio Luna Venegas versus Signet Builders. And good morning, Mr. Sneed.
Good morning.
How are you?
Very good.
Okay. What is this the judges say? You may approach? Something like that. Whenever I say come on up, I feel like I'm a game show hostess. All right.
May it please the court. This is an FLSA action where the plaintiff appellee is seeking to certify a nationwide collective against a Texas company in Wisconsin federal court. The question is whether Bristol-Myers and its claim-by-claim specific jurisdiction analysis applies to the opt-in plaintiffs who have no connection with Wisconsin.
I'm going to do a Judge Easterbrook. Isn't the jurisdictional challenge currently hypothetical and abstract?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor. It's at issue. Well, one, the district court made a ruling on it. It's
That's why we're here.
That's why we're here.
And smack them, right?
And I would suggest it's ripe. It's there's notice is about to be sent out. We know who the class is. We know that 90% of the people have no contacts with Wisconsin. So it's a clean issue. And this is the same stage the court decided similar issues in the Mussot case and the Bigger versus Facebook case, this certification or conditional certification stage. And in Bigger versus Facebook, the court said this was cautioned against sending out notice to people who could never be part of the collective because it's inefficient and because it's runs into the risk of solicitation.
Now, can you point to any case where Rule 4K1A required each and every opt-in member of an FLSA collective action to separately establish the court's personal jurisdiction over the defendant through the service of process, a mechanism that is found elsewhere in Rule 4?
Let me answer that in two ways. One, there are obviously there's a circuit split over whether the plaintiffs have to establish jurisdiction. But I want to reframe the question slightly. Our position is not each person, like the notice they have to serve each time, and that 4K requires multiple or service at each instance. Our position is this. There must be authorization for a federal court to exercise personal jurisdiction. 4K is the source of that authorization, and 4K1A authorizes limited jurisdiction that's tied to the state. And so our argument is, and our position is, and what Judge Sutton and Kennedy said, and Fisher, is that it's in the analysis of
I think it's maybe more helpful when looking at specific jurisdiction to see how our court has dealt with the issue. And so there's three principles that we kind of outline in Curry that comes after Mussot that explains that when looking at specific jurisdiction, tying the claim to the defendant's minimal contacts to the forum. That's one of the principles for purposes-specific personal jurisdiction. So I guess we need to go a little broader and say, how has our circuit dealt with FLSA plaintiffs? Are they analogous to class action unnamed members?
The circuit has not addressed this question in the sense of, in Eschbenscheid, the court said that they are, that collective actions and class actions are similar, except for the key difference is that collective actions plaintiffs opt in, where class actions they opt out. And our briefing explains the differences between the two. But I think the key framing is the question is not, is it more like a class action or more like an aggregate litigation?
I want to drill down. I know what your briefs say. Yeah. I'm asking you to drill down on the point. how are the opt-in plaintiff's claims treated in an FLSA case versus how they're treated class action of unnamed members? Because it's not covered in your brief, so I need us to drill down on that point.
Collective actions, plaintiff opts in. Mm-hmm. They have the choice of having counsel. They have appellate rights. And their claims have to be dealt with individualized.
They're not required to serve summons or to file complaints under Rule 4 opt-ins.
No, that's right. They don't have to.
That's quite a difference there.
If I can, I want to emphasize, zoom out a little bit, and what the plaintiff appellee's argument is.
And so I need to finish your question, finish the answer to my question.
Yes,
you said they have to be treated individually, they opt in. And so what cases are we relying on to suggest that opt-in plaintiff's claims have to be treated individually?
I point to the Supreme Court's decision in the Genie case that talks about how the difference on the opt-in level, the the Eschbenside case talks about how they're opt-in and they're different. I will find a case, I'll review the briefing for rebuttal on that one, on the issue of the individualized claim. That's how the actions work. I don't know that this court has discussed the individualized nature of it specifically, but you have to prove damages for,
while a named plaintiff must mm-hmm. demonstrate personal jurisdiction under Rule 4, and nowhere in the text of the rule is there a requirement that opt-in plaintiffs have to demonstrate the same. In fact, absent collective action, members who opt in are not required to serve summons or to file complaints under Rule 4. I mean, doesn't that seem like a strong indication, at the very least, that one's personal jurisdiction is established as the named plaintiff's claim? It does not have to be reestablished as to each opt-in plaintiff.
So the question is, what jurisdiction is being established? Is it tag jurisdiction or a consent jurisdiction or general jurisdiction? So once that summons happens, then anything else goes? Their argument is essentially an on-off switch, that before the summons, jurisdiction is based on contacts with the state, and then after summons, jurisdiction expands to the Fifth Amendment and it's based on contacts with the U.S. And here's the problem with that. There must be authorization for courts to exercise personal jurisdiction. The Constitution provides a limit, but not authorization. That is why this court said in the ISI case, the threshold question is whether the court has power to exert the full power of the nation, whether there's authorization to exert the full power of the nation. The question is, they have to have authorization. There has to be authorization for a court to exercise jurisdiction to the Fifth Amendment. Omni said that from the Supreme Court. This court said it in the United Rope case, which was cited by the law professors. It said it again in ISI.
So you know something, the burden of demonstrating personal jurisdiction, if we agree with you, is going to fall on the very individuals that the FLSA was designed to protect. And I can't even imagine the burden, how immense the burden will be for district courts, who will have to, they will have to adjudicate personal jurisdiction over each absent collective action member's claims. I just, as a former district court judge, wow. We would need a whole different court, another court system.
To follow up on Judge Rovner's question, would you agree that if, when the case was filed, if personal jurisdiction was based on general jurisdiction, that everybody could opt in and no jurisdiction would be established for every opt-in
Absolutely.
Plaintiff? So it's when we're talking about specific jurisdiction,
right,
given the Bristol-Myers holding.
Right.
That now, at least on particular claims, you'd have to establish it.
Absolutely.
Is there anything in the text of Rule K that supports your argument when amended complaints are filed or opt-ins are come in, that there has to be a separate analysis or a separate jurisdiction under the long-arm statute?
I'll say this. Rule 4K, 1A, it says who is subject to jurisdiction in the present tense. The court's authority, the summons establishes jurisdiction over someone who is subject to it. That is not a one-time event. And there are courts who say, regarding Rule 20, you cannot use Rule 20 to bypass personal jurisdiction. Rule 20...
Have we ever said that?
I don't think lower courts have. I don't think this court has said that.
Okay.
And I'm eating into my rebuttal time. I do want to make one other point.
Oh. No, you're not. Yes, you are.
Well, I don't want to assume how much rebuttal
time
I get.
No, you're not. Procedurally, how would a district court that lacks general personal jurisdiction over defendant have, you know, how would they verify the specific personal jurisdiction of hundreds, thousands, who knows, of opt-in plaintiffs? Okay. I mean, it would require hundreds or thousands of individual mini trials just on the question of personal jurisdiction.
So you're
trying to kill us.
I'm not trying to kill you.
Yeah, you are.
There might be a case where that's difficult or that you need discovery on it. Here, it is clean. We know, there's no dispute. 90% of the people they're sending out notice to have no contacts with Wisconsin.
But
it's
here,
clean.
You're not asking us to address the merits of that question because no notices have been sent. You're asking us to issue a rule of law,
right,
as to how to treat FLSA opt-in plaintiffs in the Seventh Circuit. And so I think Judge Rovner's question is really asking to drill down, in effect, how will this rule play out in the district court?
I would suggest that if there is a challenge to jurisdiction, the district court should or must answer it. If there are fact questions based on whether there are contacts, there can be jurisdictional discovery. But in situations where it's clean and it's there's no dispute about it, it should be decided now. I want to make one more point and then
how does a reading of Rule 4 that requires each absent collective action member to establish personal jurisdiction align with Rule 82's statement that the federal rules, quote, do not extend or limit the jurisdiction of the district courts?
The Supreme Court in the Murphy case, mm-hmm, said that's about subject matter jurisdiction, mm-hmm, period.
Period.
I want to talk briefly about the consequences and then hopefully save some time. Can I make one more point and then save a couple minutes for rebuttal?
I think we need to address, though,
if you would, yeah, if you can answer my question.
Oh, I thought I did answer your question.
Well, not to my
The Supreme Court in the Murphy case, which was Mississippi versus Murphy, 326 U.S. 438, it held that Rule 82 was about subject matter jurisdiction, mm-hmm, only. Not about, that was a challenge to the validity of rule, former Rule E or D.
So your response is Rule 82 doesn't come into play when we're talking about personal jurisdiction,
correct,
given this case.
Correct.
And what do we do with Mossad where it says Rule 4K, I'm reading from the opinion, the defendant in Mossad is mixing up the concepts of service and jurisdiction. Rule 4K addresses how and where to serve process. It does not specify on whom process must be served.
The next sentence in that Massat says, it is true that with certain exceptions, a federal district court has personal jurisdiction only over a party who would be subject to the jurisdiction of the state where the federal district court is located. That's our point. Massad supports our position. I want to recap our position briefly, and then can I have a couple minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor?
Of course.
Okay, well, I want to be careful with that. Briefly, there must be authorization for courts to exercise jurisdiction. Rule 4K is the source of authorization. 4K1A authorizes limited jurisdiction tied to the courts. In a very real sense, it doesn't matter how the court reads 4K, because even if we're wrong, even if they're right that it's silent after the summons, they can't get to where they want, and that's Fifth Amendment. Nothing authorizes jurisdiction to the Fifth Amendment. That was the point of Omni. So we have to search. Where is the authorization to go to a U.S. contacts-based jurisdictional inquiry? It doesn't exist. The only thing that 4K1A says about anything is about the state. So it's either the state or it's nothing.
And so you need us to follow the Fisher decision in the Third Circuit, that personal jurisdiction's limits in the Fifth and 14th Amendment are not self-executing. And the way that they're executed in the FLSA context is under Rule 4K.
So, yes, Your Honor. And I'll add to that.
I don't think we have time.
Yes, Your Honor. unless there are other questions, I will hopefully save 5 minutes for rebuttal. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Mead.
Good morning. Yes, Joseph Mead on behalf of Plaintiff Appellee Luna Venegas. The parties agree that the district court obtained personal jurisdiction over Signet based on service of the complaint under Rule 4K1A. This complaint alleged violations of federal labor law. He was underpaid for his overtime work in violation of federal law. The question is whether similarly situated employees can exercise their federal rights to opt into this proceeding. The Signet's argument is essentially that state law prevents the opt-in claimants from joining this federal case, exercising their federal rights. The district court properly rejected this argument, and this court should affirm.
Can we start kind of where we left off as far as no one has been able to answer the question for me? FLSA opt-in plaintiffs, how are their claims treated? We want to make this analogous to class actions. But I need some guidance here from the lawyers as to how to treat those complaints.
They are treated almost identical to class representatives in several respects.
Okay.
I'm going to start with the statute. The FLSA's text says that the named plaintiff the named plaintiff litigates on behalf of these similarly situated individuals. Thus, this court in Smith, for example, has said that the named representative, just like in a class action, has two capacities, his individual capacity and his representative capacity. The Harkins makes clear that the opt-in claimants have the merits of their decision.
And you said that was the Smith case?
I'm sorry, this is the Hawkins case?
No, before.
Oh, before it was Smith.
And do you have the citation for that?
I don't think that's what we were saying in Smith. And I'm quite familiar with that case. I think what we did say in Smith is that we were just deciding whether or not the named plaintiff had properly put the defendant on notice of her intent to sue individually because she hadn't signed any kind of an opt-in form. And she was the named plaintiff. And they were trying to kick her out because she hadn't timely filed an opt-in form. And so the question there was, has she essentially satisfied the requirements of the opt-in form by filing a complaint? Which is, I think you're going too far in your
analysis of it. I apologize, Your Honor. I might have invoked the wrong authority. But regardless, the way that this court has repeatedly described FLSA named representatives is that they proceed in two capacities, both as on their individual and as a representative of these similarly situated claimants, which is also consistent with what the FLSA statutory language provides.
How do we address what the Supreme Court has said in Genesis Healthcare, that FLSA collective action is a joinder process with significant differences from Rule 23?
It, it um, f-
First of all, a joinder is more like a mass action than a collective action.
That's right, Your Honor. But it's a joinder in the process by which the opt-in claimants participate or choose to be bound to the judgment. But it doesn't change the strength of their relationship. They're still dependent on the.
But isn't the capacity that they are suing in what's significant under Bristol-Myers? What their role is, and a joinder process means that they are there in an individual capacity as opposed to a class action where there's a representative and they are there in a class capacity, an absent class member.
We would suggest a few different responses to that. The first is that Bristol-Myers does not apply because it's a state case, yep. Well, this is federal. Yes, yeah, we can deal with that.
That's not that wasn't my point.
Fair. I apologize, Your Honor.
No, that's okay.
To your specific point, though, the statute says that they appear as party plaintiffs, but that's not the real substance of how they interact. Their connection to the litigation is entirely a function of the collective action being certified. If the collective action is decertified, they're not part of the case anymore. As Judge Posner put it in Eppensheed, their claims go poof. And that's very much like a class action. Because the resolution of the named representative's claim on the merits binds the opt-in claimants on the merits, Hawkins says that they must file those opt-in notices. It's an important procedural step to ensure they understand the consequences of opting in.
But they are individual plaintiffs who could come in with their own lawyer if they choose to, which you can't in Rule 23, and they can be subject to discovery individually.
I would respectfully disagree on both of those points. It is true that they may participate through their own lawyer, although practically they never do.
I don't know if that's true. At the district court, I had quite a few FLSA cases. I think that's an overbroad statement.
The district court suggested here that the district court thought that was true. Or not it is empirically is not the key to our argument. I will point out that in Rule 23, class members actually have the right in Rule 23C2B4 to appear through their own lawyer, although practically speaking, I don't think that happens very frequently. In terms of discovery, they're not subject to automatic discovery. Typically, they may be subject to discovery as a class member might. There might be some class discovery, a sample, for example.
And I think why it's so important for purposes of the rule that's being requested is that we have made it clear with the Seventh Circuit that absentee litigants are treated in a class action context as, in essence, non-parties. And so why I'm trying to get an answer to this question to drill down on this point is because if FLSA claims are treated as individual or individual claims, then as we gave direction in Moussat interpreting the Bristol holding, there has to be a personal jurisdiction analysis of that claim. If, however, opt-in plaintiffs are a collective or not so much a joinder context, but how we would view it as a class action context, then that personal jurisdiction analysis would not be needed because the court would have already done that when looking at the named plaintiff in the FLSA action.
And I think that is the key why FLSA collective actions are more basically identical in that respect to class actions. And the key is the named representative's resolution on the merits applies, is extrapolated to the opt-in plaintiffs. Whereas if a party joins, but through intervention or Rule 20 or whatever, as a party plaintiff, then they control their own fate. And that's not how the FLSA
collective action. But then what do we do, again, with what the Supreme Court has specifically said, that there are significant differences, and FLSA collective plaintiffs are part of a joinder process, which again is an aggregate litigation term, not a class action term.
I think the two responses, one is that they join in the process, they choose to join in that sense, so it's joinder in that sense. It's not joinder under Rule 20, and I don't think anything in the Supreme Court's decision suggests
no,
that. And I would say that this court has ratified in Harrington, footnote 4, Judge Barrett said the prior...
Done this quite a bit during argument, and so just to clarify, we issue decisions on behalf of the court, not Judge Posner or Judge Barrett. It's on behalf of the court. So out of respect for those decisions, let's keep it as decisions issued by the... that's a little bit distracting.
I apologize, Your Honor. No problem. Will do that. No, as this court has said in its prior decisions, it has affirmed that that line of cases remains valid post-Genesis. That Genesis was... the outcome of Genesis Healthcare would have been the same whether it was under Rule 23 or under the FLSA, because it dealt with a class or a collective action that had not been certified yet and involved mootness, which wasn't at issue here. But to try to get to your question, the named plaintiff must, in an FLSA case, the named plaintiff must show that they are an adequate representative, just like in a class action, because they are a representative. Their claims rise and fall. The opt-in claimants' claims rise and fall on the named plaintiff's merits. It makes sense then, if we're going to extrapolate the merits of the named representative out to the collective opt-in plaintiffs, that we do so with personal jurisdiction as well. And I would note that in this very case, Cignet argued that the collective action should not be certified because plaintiff was not an adequate representative, applying Rule 23 standards, which the district court rejected. So that understands, that contemplates, that adequacy of representation is built into the framework of collective actions. And so if you have a representative who is going to be the
circuit, we haven't necessarily endorsed that, though. I know in the two-step process, sometimes that is done, but I don't think we have necessarily endorsed that procedure.
As this court said in Eppensheed, Rule 23 standards apply to collective actions, and I think that is the mechanism by which adequacy of representation becomes tested in when deciding whether to certify.
So do you need the Fifth Amendment due process here to kick in order to succeed?
No, Your Honor. The Fifth Amendment is the only applicable constitutional limit on this case. Actually, all of these questions about collective actions, I think, are actually the second step. The first step is, what does Rule 4 provide? Rule 4 invokes state law in only a very specific way. It invokes state law at the time...
So I'm sorry to interrupt, but you said something earlier. You focus a lot on in your briefs on the Fifth Amendment, mm-hmm. and why the state law kicks in for the initial plaintiff who files the case. And then I thought your argument was, for everybody else who comes in under opt-in, we analyze it under the Fifth Amendment.
I apologize, Your Honor. I mean to say the Fifth Amendment provides the outer limit of what this court could do.
Correct.
But the Fifth Amendment is not actually implicated here because it's really a non-issue. There's no question the Fifth Amendment would be satisfied here.
It would be satisfied, right.
So the question is, Cignet's argument is that the state law limits, the 14th Amendment, state long-arm statute, is implicated by virtue of Rule 4K1A. And that's not what Rule 4K1A says.
But is your argument that we, personal jurisdiction for all of the additional opt-in plaintiffs, would be analyzed under the Fifth Amendment, and there's no issue there because that's very broad? Is that what your argument is? Or is your argument that because one plaintiff for this claim has jurisdiction under the Wisconsin long-arm statute, his personal jurisdiction over Cignet, that's all you need?
It's the latter, Your Honor.
Okay. What if it violated the Fifth Amendment?
Well, of course, subject to Fifth Amendment constraints.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I think that there's, and this is an error that the...
Doesn't that circumvent the specific jurisdiction, specific personal jurisdiction cases?
It doesn't, Your Honor. Those are pathways by which a court can obtain personal jurisdiction or power over defendant, once that power is established, and it's established through the service of the summons that is consistent with state law, once that power is established, it remains as part of the case. And I think the error that Signet and the Third Circuit and Sixth Circuit respectfully followed was that they imported a subject matter jurisdiction type analysis to the personal jurisdiction context. Mm-hmm. Subject matter jurisdiction, of course, must be maintained throughout the litigation. Personal jurisdiction is different. Historically, it's always been tied to service of the summons. And once that personal jurisdiction is obtained over the defendant, that hook remains.
But you have personal jurisdiction for a specific purpose. You have personal specific personal jurisdiction. So your argument is that once you obtain specific personal jurisdiction over a party, that the court can then expand that to general jurisdiction.
I would not use
and
those
what
terms,
supports
but,
that. But, it, yes. but that's effectively what you're doing, because if some of these other plaintiffs had sued under the FLSA in Wisconsin and been the named plaintiff, some of the plaintiffs from Texas or that didn't have specific jurisdiction over Signet, they wouldn't be able to bring this case in Wisconsin on their own right.
Correct.
So what you're saying, as long as you have one person who has specific jurisdiction, that expands the personal jurisdiction into general jurisdiction for other plaintiffs.
Essentially, it does.
What supports that?
It's the way the rule works. The language of the rule contemplates. So again, specific jurisdiction is like the flavor, I guess, of jurisdiction, but it doesn't change the level of power that the court has over the defendant. It's tied to the case, right? The case is...
Why isn't it tied to the claim?
That's
the
correct.
Courts have repeatedly talked about it as tying to the case, but whether it ties to the
there
claim...
There are many courts that have talked about it as being tied to the claim.
And whether that's true or not doesn't actually depend on our argument, because our argument is it's assessed at the time the summons is... served and not.
But what if the claim changes? What if the claim changes? Because the plaintiff's alleged injury must arise out of the defendant's contact with the state.
It's hard for me to imagine a situation that would arise where there would be totally different, but assuming that did happen, the personal jurisdiction analysis would not change. The court has already obtained personal jurisdiction over that defendant.
But when the opt-in plaintiff from an FLSA collective action comes into a case bringing individualized claims, is that not changing?
It's not. It's still the same core case. Mm-hmm. And for all of the reasons why it's a kind of a representative action and that the named representative's merits apply to the collective action. And I think the fact that this, if I could just finish my thought.
Absolutely.
If the fact that Congress explicitly authorized this procedure makes it a little bit different, even than Rule 23. Rule 23 is a federal rule. It's obviously very important, but it's not necessarily ratified by Congress in the same way.
But if Congress had wanted that, why wouldn't they have included a general jurisdiction or a nationwide service?
Because that would allow Mr. Luna Venegas, for example, to sue Signet in Idaho. There still has to be a hook. Right. And so there is a hook here. Mm-hmm. The question is what happens after that service of summons. And that is governed by the rules. And specifically here, not even the rules, is governed by a federal statute.
Judge Opener, may I ask one more question?
Of course.
So one more question for you, please, Mr. Mead. Back to what we were talking about earlier. There's specific jurisdiction over the defendant here based on the initial plaintiff. Mm-hmm. So all of these opt-in plaintiffs are going to come in, many of whom would not have specific jurisdiction if they filed in Wisconsin. I think you would agree with that.
Yes.
So if they are allowed to come in, how does that comport with the 14th Amendment due process? Given that the court has specific jurisdiction and not general jurisdiction? That's what I'm struggling with.
The answer is that the 14th Amendment would not apply.
And what is your basis for the argument that the 14th Amendment would not apply in that context?
My argument is that the 14th Amendment applies only by virtue of Rule 4K1A, which is triggered only at the summons stage. It's not triggered at later stages where mm-hmm. there is no Rule 4K summons.
Okay.
And I would, if I can just add one sentence to that,
please.
I would note that many of the leading scholars of the country filed an amicus brief, including Arthur.
Yeah, well, we've read those.
Okay, which I thought would laid it out in that regard too. So I, for those reasons, the court should affirm the district court. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Okay. Mr. Sneed, 5 minutes.
You've been gracious with your time. I'll take up less unless there's questions. I have 3 quick points to make.
Okay.
Okay.
Go.
1, on the Mossot issue and representative, I think the proof is in the pudding, so to speak. There has been one opt-in plaintiff, docket number 20, notice of consent. Docket number 108 is the second amended complaint. There's 2 plaintiffs on the title. Second, on the power is established, once the cases they cite in their briefing involve TAG jurisdiction and consent jurisdiction, which we agree. So Burnham versus Superior, TAG jurisdiction. Mallory versus Norfolk and Adam versus Sanger, consent jurisdiction. We agree. Power established once. That's different than specific jurisdiction. Last point. The consequences, what they're asking for is a dramatic change in the law. Daimler says, federal courts ordinarily follow state law in determining the bounds of their jurisdiction over persons, C4K. That was a federal question case. If they're right, Daimler was wrong, or at least wildly incomplete. And so is Omni and all the other cases that say the essentially the same thing. And they would essentially have the court upend 250 plus years of personal jurisdiction just so they can avoid Texas. They can seek a nationwide collective in Texas. They can seek a Wisconsin collective in Wisconsin, or even if there's multiple states, multiple collectives, and try to consolidate them. But Signet should not be forced to defend itself in Wisconsin on claims that have nothing to do with Wisconsin. So unless there are any other questions, we ask the court to join the 3rd, 6th, and 8th circuits and to vacate the order below with instructions to limit the notice to just those with Wisconsin contacts.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all, everyone. Thank you, Mr. Snee. Thank you, Mr. Mead. Case will be taken under advisement.